greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in that original and unaltered form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, a show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong in this country and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal revival aimed at making each of us more responsible, much more cooperative, and increasingly aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us, no matter what we find to squabble over. Now, you can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call from Canada to 888-810-8322, or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for the show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly or even extra-humanly possible on the station archives. And for information and links from these shows, you can go to offthegridstofreedom.blogspot.com or just email me if you didn't grab a pencil. Lots happening, and lots needs to happen to make freedom for all of us real. Now, my blog site is titled How the Neocons Stole Freedom and is conveniently located at howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. This week, the story at the top, which I just placed last night, is a sequel to the recent article that I wrote on Blackstone Group. And included is another article from a new writer who experienced the hyperinflation that took place in the Soviet Union starting in 1985. Now, that should scare you. I focus on what we need to do to survive and take back America. More is on the way in my book, Off the Grids to Freedom, out soon. And now, news from the rumblings of the web. Today is September 21st, the day that those shorts expire and the $1 billion that hinged on them is lost to the individual or group who bet that our economy would have declined by about 50%. That's sort of some good news, but the bad news is that the reason that that didn't happen was because of the fiddling with the interest rate. So at least we know that the Bush administration didn't want that to happen yet. And here's some other stories now predicting our direction. September 18, 2007, U.S. banks brace for a storm surge as dollar and credit system reel. And another article, a Fed panic and a massive bailout of American banks paid for by the entire world. And Bankei abolishes corrections and bank losses. I'm going to read you a little tiny piece of this by Michael Swanson. I was shocked by yesterday's decision by the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates by 50 basic points and then signal that there is more to come in its statement. The Fed is in a tough bind. I know there are frightening things happening in the credit markets, and banks and Wall Street is clamoring for rate cuts. We saw the near collapse of Countrywide Financial a few weeks ago, and England's Northern Rock has experienced a full-fledged bank run. At the same time, though inflation is accelerating as oil prices hit all-time highs and gold breaks through the $700 an ounce, and the Dow is only 1.7 off of its all-time high. If you get that things out there are going down, then you're exactly right. And I really do suggest that you read my article up there this week. And now, a comment, question, is the Iraq war worth it? Answer, if I'd known then what I know now, I would have done, would I have done the same? The answer, I think, is, I don't know, Robert Gates, U.S. Secretary of Defense. Now, that's kind of scary, isn't it? Do you think that's what the U.S. Secretary of Defense is saying? And two major figures came out with comments that made George Bush very unhappy this last week. And, of course, that in and of itself is a good thing. Former head of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, in his memoir, admitted that the war in Iraq is all about oil. And then, in the Washington Post op-ed, a former U.S. Secretary of State, Kissinger, comes clean on the true motives behind the planned military assault on Iran. Quote, an Iran that practices subversion and seeks regional hegemony, which appears to be the current trend, must be faced with lines it will not be permitted to cross. The industrial nations cannot accept radical forces dominating a region on which their economies depend, writes Kissinger. Well, we all know how true that one is. And what something that came across my desk right before the show started from a very dear old friend who started the Earth Society. And she urged me, and I urge you, not to miss something that's going to be airing on Bill Moyer's Journal tonight, Rachel Carson's Legacy. Bill Moyer's Journal looks at the life and legacy of Rachel Carson and her book, Silent Spring, which launched the modern environmental movement. And now, right now, Yom Kippur is about to start. And this day is the Day of Atonement. Remember this as we live through these hours in time. This holy day of the Jewish people includes an ancient ceremony, the Sofar, the blowing of the ram's horn. And this is a moment when we, you and I, are called to examine our individual spiritual journey and question what we do and what we allow to be done in our names. Be aware. Wake up to yourself and to the world. And now a revelation from Revelations. In chapter 9, there's a verse that describes the evil one, the beast. That verse is preceded by several other verses describing what would happen and then the charge under which the people were to live. And the first of these say, he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. And now we come to the verse that gives us the description of the evil one, the beast. That verse reads, and they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue his name is Apollyon. And the number for that verse is 9-11. From the book that is deemed the prophecy for the future of the world that would precede the second coming. Amazing. And amazing that George Bush thinks that the rapture could be a good thing for him. The most powerful monarch in the world today is George W. Bush. Therefore, George W. Bush is the beast. The evil done by those who were joined with the beast was to cause great clouds of smoke to be spewed into the air, darkening the earth. By so doing, the earth was rendered barren, as if locusts had fed on her. Now, doesn't that sound like the oil companies and old beast George should get their comeuppance? And now, this morning I received from a fellow host at BBS, Juliet Nightingale, the following. Oh, about the announcement I put out about our show tonight. Oh, this is so true. Last night I was in tears by realizing all of the violence going on in your country. This includes cops arresting a woman for merely reading some American Constitution in public at the demonstration in D.C., I believe, and a bloke being zapped by cops and arrested because he was, albeit assertively, asking questions of some politician in Florida, and on and on and on. In your paragraph, I've replaced the word Americans with individuals. Not all of us are American, and only stating Americans excludes the rest of us. We're all dealing with this horror, and we need to reach across borders and help one another as a human family of individuals. And, you know, I think all of us absolutely would have to agree with Juliet, and I certainly do, because what's happening here is really in many ways happening to everybody across the face of the earth. And I've got a little good news from the Ron Paul Revolution. Harris poll, Ron Paul is polling 10% among 18 to 25-year-olds, despite what the mainstream media has been trying to do in suppressing his message. And Ron Paul finished second in the South Carolina straw poll yesterday, bringing in 33 against a field that included Huckabee with 39, Thompson with 33, Brownback with 29, Hunter with 25, with 14. Thompson had 6%, Brownback had 5%, Hunter had 5%, Romney had 3%, Gilbert had 2%, McCain had 2%, Court had 1%, and Giuliani, lucky guy, had 1% himself. Ron's numbers continue to rise in all groups as more Republicans find a reason not to lead, and independents and Democrats begin re-registering to support the Republican who votes his conscience and the Constitution. And now you can get your own free Ron Paul email address. Imagine for a moment all the emails you send out to people that have nothing to do with Ron Paul. But when they see your email address saying either googleronpaul.net or voteforronpaul.net, they will pause, wonder, perhaps Google, and then they'll find out. It doesn't really take much to convert the curious into supporters when the candidate is selling something that people so desperately want. And that, of course, what Ron Paul is selling is freedom. So just go to googleronpaul.net or voteforronpaul.net to get yours today. And thanks to Greg Slaughter, the ticket slayer, for his hard work on the site. And next week, get ready for a real online game show that we're calling Name That Rat. And the rat is going to be some member of the administration or the corporations, the one that is perhaps annoying us the most at that point in time. Right and left, the Ron Paul campaign is bringing Americans together like never before. And that's a good thing for freedom and a bad thing for the corporations. And now about our guest today. Connie Shannon is a writer and activist and musician who lives in Los Angeles, moving there from Texas, where she was raised in Highland Park, an exclusive enclave near the Dallas Country Club. Ms. Shannon's family were close friends with George W. and Laura Bush, and her brother Jim served as campaign chairman for George W.'s first campaign for governor of Texas. Ms. Cannon attended Stevens College, graduating in 1986. Connie became active in politics more or less by default after the 2000 election was given to George Bush by the Supreme Court. She's been very active in issues concerning the illegal occupation of Iraq, and also is active in stopping the use of electronic voting machines, which are owned and operated by conservative companies with vested interest in election outcomes, and is dedicated to waking up more women to the importance of participating and becoming aware and active in the political world. Please welcome Connie Shannon. Shannon, Connie, are you there?
I'm here.
I am so glad that you could be with us today.
I am too, Melinda. You know, this is a big pleasure. We have talked about this for a while.
Yes, we have. But all things come in good time, right?
Yes, they yes, they do, absolutely.
And we always like to start by asking our guests to tell us a little something about themselves. So tell us a little bit more about Connie.
Well, you certainly did a great introduction. I grew up in Dallas, and my parents, my father was a doctor. My mother was, I guess, more or less a socialite, you may say. And I'm the youngest of five kids, the only girl. And I have four brothers, and two of my brothers have been very involved in politics. I lived in Dallas until I moved out to L.A. in December of 1999, and then I interestingly enough, started getting involved on the Gore campaign and did some volunteer work and worked down in South Los Angeles. And just through that, a series of awakenings happened for me, and then, of course, the whole outcome of that election was a real turning point for me. Interestingly enough, I had, in my teenage years, had been involved in politics really through my brother Jim and Debbie, and just in their involvement got involved on the Republican side. And
that's an interesting transition you made there.
It really was. And I think that going to a women's college, which really where we had to take women's studies courses, was a real pivotal thing at the time. My poor women's studies teacher, I tell everybody, because at the time I was so fervently, Republicanized, so to speak, that I'm sure I was quite a troublemaker, but she really opened my eyes to asking the right questions and to just asking questions, period, which I really get concerned about that a lot of, you know, kids these days and are not being taught how to critically think and to ask questions. And I was very lucky that I had that opportunity. It's probably, you know, it's certainly been challenging in my family or for me because I you know, that was probably certainly part of the separation and just kind of growing into being who I am, but very important all the same. And so I think after college, I went back to Dallas. My father died in 1985 when I was 19, and I got my degree in theater. For lack of a better reason, I went back home because I thought it was the right thing to do. And I think when I got back there, I began to, you know, see how I was changing.
Your perspective had changed because you had more information.
Absolutely.
And so you'd hear your, you know, your brother and your sister-in-law and your mom saying things, and all of a sudden you went, well, wait a minute.
Right. And had been taught certainly to speak out, and that was a wonderful thing that my brother and sister-in-law taught me and gave, is that we would engage in discussion, and that was a gift. I think it became a challenge when I began to see things, you know, differently, and I began to question some of the things that I had believed without question, when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that caused conflict in the family.
Because
all of a sudden it wasn't everybody nodding their head and saying yes.
Yeah, I think so. I think it probably also, in some ways, provided more engaging discussions because there at least was somebody, you know, that was at least making it, you know. There weren't many liberals in Dallas, for that matter, and I think that... I don't know if I was a liberal, I was just somebody who was really starting to pay attention and ask questions. So in one sense, it certainly made it more lively, but I think it also, as time went on, it became more painful for me, really, because I felt myself being, you know, I felt more separated, more alienated from the family. Not necessarily that they brought it. I'm sure they noticed. You know, we all noticed it, but you know, it was just me evolving and in a place that didn't really, in my belief, in my experience, it was Highland Park is a place that really doesn't. And there are many places in the United States, but didn't advocate.
Many of the people listening may not understand about Highland Park. But they call it the bubble. And it's a place where there really isn't a lot of contact with reality. And that's one of the things that the people there like, and they characterize it. That's the way you experienced it too, right?
I think Highland Park is representative of a lot of very wealthy areas, you know, be it... you know, River Oaks or be it Santa, you know, areas, Brentwood or any areas that that have a lot of money. And it's interesting, when I was young, very young in HP, there was still the remnants of the small town feel, and the money had not just, you know, saturated the Highland Park yet. I think in the 80s is when the whole thing, and I'm sure a lot of places can say that things just, you know, went up a whole different level and volume. And I think that in the 80s, I really started noticing the changes, the preppiness, you know, the issues, just the whole influence of money and the value of money as far as terms of defining success became even greater and continued to increase after the 80s. Yeah.
And there, it was different in some ways. If you take a look at the statistics of how many, you know, young people actually went in to the Army during the Vietnam conflict or later, it was a shrinkingly tiny percentage of the people who actually served, which made it different than the rest of the country.
Sure.
They weren't drafted.
What a good point. You know, and so there is another part of the separation between the wealthy and the, you know, the less wealthy. Start of the dissolution, probably the middle class. Yeah. Very much. And of course, you know, all of this has been happening incrementally, and we haven't really been seeing it. It's been a very slow process.
It's that little frog in the
pot.
In the little pot who's being boiled.
Right.
Not really a very attractive image, but there you are. It's very accurate.
And I think you're right.
And when did you get to know the Bushes? And you got to know them before they were actually at all, in, you know, really directly involved in politics, right?
Right. I met, I guess, George and Laura, it was probably 1990. It was either 1990 or 91, and it was at lunch over at my brother and sister-in-law's. It was Thanksgiving. I had a couple of luncheons with them, but George and Laura were there. And so I'm going to say I was probably 26. I liked them immediately. I George was very funny and very polite, and Laura was, you know, incredibly gracious and very approachable and kind, and I would say at that point, I don't really know, but I would say, and I put it in an article that I wrote recently on my website, that it was really seemed like an innocent time, a much more innocent time certainly than it is now, and the pressure was certainly not there, I would think, and so that's when I met them. So,
and as you said, you liked them, you had a good time with them, you came to feel very comfortable with them.
I did. I didn't see them a tremendous amount. I would see them at, you know, events with the family and whenever they would come over. And then when I went down to the lake, my brother Jim has a lake house down outside of Athens, Texas, and George and Laura did too as well before they, you know, bought Crawford. And so whenever I would visit and go down there, they were often there. And so, you know, we would go on walks, and or they'd come over for dinner, and you know, I'd play the guitar, and it was just it was nice. And I think but that was really before he decided to run for governor, and then it was also during his governorship too. Yeah, so
you noticed changes in him over that period of time, right?
Yeah, I guess you could say I saw, you know, some changes.
What was he like before that? You said he was funny and nice and good to be around.
And comfortable. I think he was when I saw him, you know, it seemed he was very laid back. You know, I think that there was just a normality there. It told a very, he was hysterical at telling stories, always told a good story. And, you know, loved to fish. I think probably, you know, if there's one thing that I could say in knowing George, that probably one of his favorite places, if he could be, would just be on a boat fishing. mm-hmm. Out in the middle of the lake.
So he really didn't show a lot of ambition. He just liked hanging out.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I would say in that respect, I think he was very laid back, and wasn't. I don't know if I could. You know, of course, down at the lake, I don't think we're going to see anybody really with an ambitious streak, because that's a pretty laid-back atmosphere. But, I didn't see, and that's what I saw. Yeah, just a really laid-back
mm-hmm.
person. Yeah.
But then he did decide to run for governor, which is a pretty ambitious thing to do.
That it is. That it is. I don't know what really, I'm not trying to think of the word, is instigated that. I'm assuming from what I can remember, it seemed like from the media and from all points, there was a lot of media pressure. There was a lot of constant speculation of will he run or not. There was some pressure coming from certainly the media, and I would imagine probably the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. Do you think his father had a role in that?
I would probably say yes. I would think, his father certainly is very influential, and I would think that, he was very loyal to his father, and it certainly struck me. Everybody seemed to, have a lot of respect and I'm not sure what the word is, but they, I'm certain that, he certainly would mm-hmm. listen to his father tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So they had a warm relationship.
I don't know. I never met his father. I never met Barbara Bush. I don't know. It seemed that, George Bush was very powerful. George H.W. Bush was very powerful in everybody's eyes. So I don't know if it would be I don't know what kind of relationship it was, but there was a lot of respect for his power
mm-hmm.
and his authority. Yeah, that was my perception, I guess.
But what happened? I know things happened when you started moving in a particular direction that sort of was defining what you thought and who you were, so that you weren't viewing the Republican Party or the policies that later came to be adopted by the Bush administration, first in Texas and then nationally.
Right. Well, I think when he became governor, and even before that, I had a real conflict, and I knew that I couldn't go up against the family. And yet it was a great conflict for me because I was very interested in politics, interestingly enough, because they, it's funny how I had become sparked with the interest in being involved or interested in political issues, ironically through my siblings and through Jim and Debbie and through their friends. But as my beliefs began to change, there was that conflict because I was certainly finding myself supporting people like Ann Richards or wanting to, and knowing that that was not appropriate, or feeling that it wasn't appropriate that I could do that. When he became governor, I became very disappointed in watching what he was doing, and very disheartened because I the choices he was making were a lot about dismantling important legislation or regulations and or things that I valued, and so I do remember at one point there was a friend that had a newspaper that was very, it was the only little publication in Dallas that was shining the spotlight on a lot of what George was doing that was just, critical.
What was do you remember the name of the publication?
It was called Aware.
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 Okay.
It was a small newspaper, and I think Lynn Knoll was the one that did it, and she and I became friends through the pro-choice, through a pro-choice group, and, I gathered he was probably aware that at that point, it was certainly known that I was, the liberal one in the family. So I think there were times that I did see him, and things were, probably less comfortable per se, after he became governor. And it could have been a lot just on my part, but it did seem, you know, he was becoming more guided, I guess, or more, it just wasn't as comfortable anymore, I think. And part of that, again, could have been, you know, my own feelings of disagreeing and being disappointed with choices he was making.
Mm-hmm.
And also being very, again, feeling very, really being one of the only one, maybe two people, my sister-in-law's sister, there were only two people, both of us women in the family that were the ones that had a different perspective than everybody else.
So the person in the family who made a lot of the political decisions was really your brother, Jim.
He
sort of led the way?
I would say, and you know, as far as certainly his he had been involved in politics, and, you know, since before Nixon. I mean, he had been involved very long and very active, and probably even back in high school or in college. So I think he did certainly hold the authority in our family because of his involvement, and he had been, you know, so involved through the, you know, so, you know, certainly, and Debbie too, you know, was very passionate and involved in the Republican Party too on the women's side. I think at one point she was the county chair. She held a position, I guess about 10 years ago, maybe the county chair for the Republican Party. I'm not exactly sure. I don't have the right. It was one of those positions. I'm not exactly sure what it was about, you know. So she's been very involved too. They've both been very, very,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So they're very linked in, and it's interesting because people have different experiences with this. But of course, I came from a very political family,
right.
And we had certainly had some friends, you know, and we had relatives who certainly didn't believe, you know, agree with us politically. But I don't recall any of them ever, you know, receiving the sort of, you know, pressure that you seem to have received. Was viewed as more of a sort of a normal thing. Everybody's, well, people are going to have different opinions.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think in fairness...
And I have to say that my family was very Republican. They had been very strong supporters of Goldwater.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that... certainly back in those times when I lived in Dallas, it was, you know, I was certainly had a right to my opinions. I think what was concerning and they're not here to respond, but I think that what I felt was it was okay for me to, you know, explain and debate at the dinner table, but for me to become somewhat effective or somewhat involved was not going to be really appropriate. And, you know, again, they're not here to respond. They would probably would disagree with that. But that was my feeling, and that was, in some ways, that was my experience, you know. I think that, you know, the situation with the Bill Clinton sticker on my car.
Well, tell us what happened with that.
Well, I mentioned that a little bit in the story that I wrote, but I think that I decided at one point to put a Bill Clinton sticker on my car, which I thought about a long time, you know, and I think that I did it for many reasons. One, it was because I felt like my voice was irrelevant, and I think that I think it was in some ways to show that I did have a right to put something on my, you know, to express myself, freedom of speech,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Yeah.
There was a situation, you know, at my mother's funeral where my brother, you know, pulled me aside and said that George had seen the sticker on my car. And anyway, it was kind of an awkward situation. And, you know.
Sort of an awkward time, too.
And an awkward time, yeah. And I think that was really kind of a... indicative, it was a situation what's indicative of really how I felt, that I did feel oppressed, I guess, in a way that, and I think it was oppressive for everybody. I don't think it was, you know, I don't think my brother, you know, my brother would not have been somebody who I don't think would have had a problem with a sticker. I think it was, you know, but there has been increasingly, certainly as the years have gone on, overall, that of this feeling of well, look at our free speech zones now.
Right.
You know, the free speech is slowly being herded into a cage. And I think that part of the reason why I wrote that article has been my experiences, and my experiences to speak out against the Bush policies and what's happened with me and my experiences. And it's increasingly got intimidating and threatening. And I think that we see that I'm just, you know, there are many people that we see that are being intimidated for saying what they believe to be true and what is often true. And so it's very important that you've experienced it as well. It's very important for people to speak out, and I think that you know, it is.
Yes, of course, it's extremely important that each of us speak out, and you know, we've all experienced, especially of late, you know, an increasing amount of behavior, like seeing people beaten, like this happened recently,
mm-hmm.
is the sort
Absolutely.
Of thing where you see it, and it, we start asking ourselves, should I say anything? Should I do something?
Right.
And one of the reasons we perhaps decide not to is because of what we have seen happen, and so therefore what we know is possible.
Right.
And that was sort of what you experienced.
Right. Right. I think that you know, the issue, but the problem is that if we allow people to intimidate us or try to silence us, then all of us become vulnerable to it, and even they do, interestingly enough.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they don't seem to realize. Even they do. And so when one person is vulnerable, everybody is. And it just makes, you know, they may not see it immediately, but eventually they will see it as well. And that's the ever-important thing of what you're doing and the incredible articles you've written and the things that you've done to talk about this have inspired me, as they've inspired others. And so, yeah.
Well, it's all of us together doing it.
That is.
And people need to be called on it when they're doing things that are inappropriate.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. It's basic right and wrong and basic, you know, stepping over the boundaries. And absolutely. And it's just happening on a big, big, big wide swing now.
Could you mind sharing a few of the things that have happened to you? That made you feel more intimidated?
Well, sure. I think a lot, you know, it's kind of interesting how to really kind of explain. I think what they do when they really try to intimidate people, and what I have experienced, is really a sense of trying to frighten me and isolate me by having either people, you know, middle-aged men parked outside my house for hours for no reason, or my trash being literally taken, my roommate found a lockpick outside our door. I've had situations where I've come in and you know, there have been situations that have being tracked to and from my tennis club, and I think, you know, other things that certainly
mm-hmm.
people with a lot of money seem to have able to have access to do this. And, you know, it's those are some of the things. There have been other things, though, too.
So did you sort of get the feeling that you were being sent a message that we're here and we're watching you, so sort of toe the line?
Yeah. You know, certainly that realm, to you know, absolutely to sensitize and, you know, to intimidate. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. And And somebody might not necessarily think about that if they hadn't been through the things that you had been through previously, that you had, when you were growing up, you had experienced, you know, a sense of pressure. This is something you shouldn't say, and we shouldn't even have to tell you not to say it because it's disloyal. It's not appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a type of punishment, I think. Or, you know, certainly an attempt. And I think that that's what's very upsetting is the kind of a vindictive tone that comes from elements of power now. You know, mm-hmm. you're either with us or against us, and very secretively, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
And that's something that, of course, we've seen so much of late. I mean, it seems like practically a day doesn't go by when you don't see one of these incidents, where you have a misuse of police power,
mm-hmm.
and now they're actually more likely to make it into the news. I know for a long time it seemed like they were being buried,
mm-hmm.
and you
mm-hmm.
weren't hearing about them. You might hear about them from somebody who had actually, you know, seen it happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really the presence of media, people's cell phones,
mm-hmm.
people's cameras that had just happened to be there. Those are the incidents we see, but it leads you to wonder how many of those incidents, when somebody doesn't have a cell phone, we don't see. And we've also heard about people who tried to record them who were then charged with, you know, a felony for doing
right.
something that's very clearly their right to do.
Right. It's interesting right now. We have a really, it's such an interesting time with our media that's, you know, basically owned by, from what I can see now, you know, or operated by five wealthy males that, you know, are the ones that allow the information to be dispelled. And so I think at this point we have to be very skeptical of our media, and yet, you know, and ask why they're doing the things that they are. You know, absolutely there are these situations, and but the promotion of fear and the sensationalism of events is it's hard to know what's live and what's Memorex really right now with our media.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, you and I have talked about it, of really how do we get to the truth, and I think part of it is really going back to watching less of the television and connecting more with people one on one, and creating places to assemble. That's one thing that I think that the spying and things like that really is a lot about trying to block our ability to assemble and to come together and to, you know, actively oppose what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that would have been very different. Can you imagine for a moment if you take away the whole presence of the Internet, the presence of technology as it exists for us to be able to document,
mm-hmm.
how very different where we are today would be from where we are.
Right. Very, very true. So I think that's true. It's also important for us to realize, though, if the plug got turned off, or the plug was pulled out of the socket, what do we do? Who do we know that we can move on and easily adapt, if that
mm-hmm.
were to occur, you know, and to realize that really our biggest strength is off the Internet and talking on the front porch with people, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you see them face to face, and you're really
people.
Having a relationship.
Right, you're really having a relationship. What a good point.
So instead of this sort of remote thing where in many cases you don't even necessarily know who you're talking to.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a big, big point. Yep.
Yes. And I'm sure that this is all of it. You know, you've gone through a lot of different sorts of seasons of change in the way you looked at this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, trying to understand what's real there and what isn't and what the rules are, because from listening to what you say, and let me just see how this, you know, works, it's like you can't even be sure what the rules are because they said no, but they never say yes, really, unless it's something that you simply have no inclination to do whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're entering kind of an interesting conversation. Certainly, we can, and you and I, because we talk on things and at such length, absolutely, you bring up a really good point of, you know, the rules change, the lines change, move. And I think that it shows that there really aren't rules, or there are rules for us, but there are no rules for those, you know, controlling the strings, I guess, per se.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that's where, you know, we have to really kind of, again, you know, what you and I talked about, and I think that we have a system right now, a system that really rewards negative behavior and negative choices.
Absolutely.
And so when you have a system like that, you have ordinarily good people that are not making good and moral decisions,
mm-hmm.
because the system is rewarding bad behavior. So you have a situation where culture is what's the saying, the culture of corruption. We really have to prove to others and show to others, as Martin Luther King was trying to, and others, but we really have to prove that, you know, that it's not going to benefit them any more than it's benefiting us.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Iraqis, or anybody, but the system affects all of us, and it's important that nobody benefits from it in the long run. That's the whole key.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, we're all certainly being impacted by the behavior that we see in this administration, which must be incredibly painful for you.
It has been. Sure. It has been.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very, very painful to see the impact on my family and my, you know, and the choices, you know, made there, and with you know, certain members of my family. But it has been very,
mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, it's I'm certainly, again, not the only one, and I've also heard how, you know, this has really happened across the country, that there have been, you know, significant, you know, splits in families, and
mm-hmm.
and hopefully that will, you know, change in time, and things will.
Well, things will. People will come back together.
Come back together.
Because
yeah.
that would definitely be a wonderful thing to see happen. That to have people understand what was inappropriate, and then come back together from where they are now,
mm-hmm.
which divides
mm-hmm.
all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And. You have 4 brothers,
mm-hmm.
and it's actually your oldest brother, Jim, who was Bush's campaign chairman when he first ran for governor.
Mm-hmm. He was state chair, uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had your other brothers, another one of them is active in politics?
Right, Charles, and he is the founder of a group called the Republican Unity Coalition. And he is in D.C. So, right. And then my other 2 brothers are back in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you do have a variety of, you know, your brothers do different things, and they all have tended to stay in the Republican fold.
I would say that, you know, I would say that, you know, 2 of my brothers aren't probably as active. They aren't as active. I would say have conservative philosophies, if that's the right term. I'm not sure what conservative means anymore.
Well,
things to so many different people, you know. It's
that,
funny.
It when used to mean something very specific.
You know, I actually think conservative is a great word that's kind of being held hostage. Conservative to conserve is a good thing, you know. I'm conservative on many levels.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then there are other things that, you know, I guess you could call me more liberal, whatever that means as well. You know, it's difficult. I think these words are being used to divide people, and that's what worries me.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're all, to me, a blend of all those things. And I think that paying attention is really the key. And if liberal means paying attention, then I guess we're all, you or I are liberal.
Well, that's funny. I mean, let's take a look at what a conservative used to be. There was a time, I mean, Barry Goldwater epitomized conservative thought for a long time, and he and his wife helped found Planned Parenthood in Arizona.
Right, absolutely.
And you look at
and
that.
What more conservative issue, I mean, it's a very conservative issue, would be to plan your parenthood.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, when you see the reaction to Planned Parenthood, there's a vilification that goes on that is really kind of shocking.
Right.
And when you take a look at how these changes in attitude took place and when, they very much seem to link back to a political agenda that has
Absolutely.
Been extremely present and is very much associated with the whole Bush family.
And I think an overall philosophy, I guess, of using a woman's right to choose as a political football to keep women, I'm assuming, certainly to create division. A lot of this always seems to go back to creating division. And, and certainly who benefits from creating division seems to be those that are doing the dividing, really.
But one of the overarching themes I see here with the case we saw with Meyer, with the case we saw with Snyder, with the case that just took place with the MIT student, the girl who had just happened to walk into an airport, is that there's a level of fear and intimidation that we simply now seem to assume is appropriate when it certainly never existed before. I can't even imagine having been afraid to go into the airport or worry about what I was wearing.
Right. Well, and I think, again, you go back to the media manufacturing this fear and who benefits from that. I think that I'm surprised tasers are even legal. The tasering of the elderly woman who was disabled in a wheelchair and the police intentionally tasered her 10 times and they killed her. I can't imagine anything being called anything more than murder on that. I mean, the woman could not defend herself. And, of course, there apparently she was very frightened. She had a knife because she was scared that her one of her family members was coming to harm her. She was schizophrenic. But there's a gun on a policeman. There's a taser and to incapacitate her, not to mention to what tasers do to a heart. And the jolt they do, especially people with heart problems, and the potential that, if people dying a couple of days later from being tasered, it's very frightening.
It is, and we live, again, back to that word, we live with so much fear today. Could you please tell our listeners about your website?
I'm happy to. It's really in its beginning stages. It's called ConniesPage.com, and I put up articles that interest me and that I think are important issues of the day. And I also love tennis. I'm a big tennis player, as you know.
Oh yes,
and
I know.
Absolutely. And I haven't put as much up on music, which I'd like to start doing, because I do play the guitar and sing, and I love that. And I'm, that's a big part of my passion. But that's, really right now, I think there's just so much going on right now with the creation of just so much chaos in the world. And I'm really hoping, I think there's so much power with us as women, Melinda, and I think...
Oh, amen.
I'm hoping it's been, I've met some incredible women on this journey, you certainly being one of them, and I think that, I'm concerned that we're hearing all these primarily white male voices on the shows this morning and the Tim Russerts and all these people acting as authorities when all they're doing seemingly is just to promote more war and more profiteering and assuming that we're going into Iran and instead of even asking the question.
Yes, well, there's so many questions that need to be asked. Well, Connie, I want to thank you for being with us today.
You're more than welcome.
And I hope you're going to be back.
Absolutely.
Because there is so much that we as women need to do.
Absolutely, Melinda.
Okay, God bless.
Thank you, and you take care.
Okay, good night.
Okay, good night.
And that's our show for today, Friday, September 21st, 2007. We need the truth. If we owe each other nothing else, we owe everyone that. And that's the message that says, I love you. On this show, As we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence. That's America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.